Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
If he hadn't been such a mediocre student, Rodrigo Soto wouldn't have been assigned the unpopular subject of organic viticulture for his university thesis. But his poor grades changed his life. Listen to us chat about what he learned from biodynamic guru Alan York, why vintage variation is a good thing, the complexity of the Napa Valley's terroir, and how he plans to take Quintessa to the next level. Hi, Rodrigo. How are you?
Tim, excellent. Yeah, my back hurts a little bit. I've been moving boxes all weekend. I'm changing from one house to another one. We just make a big commitment to the region here in Napa. So with my wife and the girls, we're moving to a new house. So we're very, very excited.
Fantastic. And you're at the winery now, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
On a Sunday morning.
On a Sunday morning, it's going to be 29 degrees on the spring. So it's going to be a hot day today in Napa, for sure.
Well, and hot days in Napa can get pretty hot when you're up the far end of the valley,
oh
right, Calistoga.
God. Tim, do you know what? The first time that I was living here, my body has never been exposed to those temperatures before. So my eyes were watering. I couldn't believe it.
Listen, lots of stuff I want to talk to you about. Let's begin with your kind of first break in wine. And you're one of a number of winemakers who started working in a restaurant in your school holidays. You were in a steakhouse, I think, wasn't it, in Pucón. Was that what got you interested in wine?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, in wine, into physical work, into understand a multitasking, a lot of things that happens in a restaurant. You know, it's one of the professions that I recommend to anybody, that everybody should work in a restaurant at least once in their life, because it's a lesson for life. I mean, absolutely. And that's where, at the time, Tim, it was like four wines in the list. It was Tarapacá, Concha y Toro, Santa Rita, and Undurraga. And people ask you, would you mind, I would like the wine a little chambray. And I was, what's that, sir? I mean, I was saying, you need to warm it up. No, I mean, at that time, Tim, and I wanted to understand what to recommend. So I find myself in a library store buying my first wine guide at the time and trying to understand wine a little bit better.
And have you still got it? You still got the guide?
Yeah, I have it somewhere. I mean, I have it somewhere. It was one of the, I'm sure you have met that the Prieto brothers used to have this Chilean wine guide many, many years ago. And that's kind of one of the first ones, I guess.
And were
it
you
was
a good
not very thick.
And were you a good waiter?
I was a good one. Yeah, you know what? It teach me a lot of tolerance as well for difficult customers. I mean, but it was fun because it was the restaurant of one of my best friends' father. He was a folklore artist in Chile, Willy Bascuñán. And Willy used to have this restaurant in Pucón where I used to spend vacations with my parents. And this was the gate for independence. This was the autonomy at a very young age to have a little job. No, it was not a little job. It was every day till very late at night. But we have a lot of fun. And I did this for multiple years. It was a lot of fun. I learned a lot.
That's a good start. I mean, you said you were a great waiter, but you weren't a great student. You went to the Catholic University in Santiago in Chile. And the story is that you ended up studying organic farming, which has become a speciality of yours. Mm-hmm. And you did your thesis on organic pest control, but by default, because nobody else wanted to do it. Is that true, that story?
Tim, I will say mediocre is a good word for the quality of student that I was. But you know what? It was, I figured out late. I was immature. Let's call it like that. I was very immature on those days, but when I figured it out, it was too late in the career. It was choosing your major, basically, and I really like it. I thought I'd find my path, But my past was condemning me because of my poor grades. And at the time, the hot topics was about fermentation, was about different things that today I found them very, very boring. And also they assign you the topic based on your grades. And as my grades were very poor, I have the last choice. And believe it or not, I saw the list and everything was taken except for this topic about biological control related to organic farming. And I said, "Boop, I'll take it." And it was a super cool professor that she was just coming back from Berkeley from making her PhD. So we get along super well. It was fantastic experience for me. And at the time, I start doing my research work in Carmen, which was the only place that was doing organic at the time under Alvaro Espinosa.
Amazing guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Incredible.
So what did you learn from him? Did you learn from Alvaro a lot, I imagine?
I learned, to be fairly honest, at the time I was very young and what I remember from Alvaro at the time was how charismatic he was.
Yeah.
And how close to his people. And how important I realized that was at a very early stage of my career, that to be close to your workers and to be close to your team. Alvaro does that better than anybody else. He's a super warm, charming personality, apart from his passion for wine and for biodynamics, of course. But that was the part that I learned from him the most, his quality as a person.
Yeah, I would agree with that. He's a fantastic guy. I mean, another person who's very influential in your life was Alan York. He's not with us anymore, sadly, but he was really kind of the biodynamic guru, wasn't he? And you've said that he taught you lessons for life as well. Just tell us a bit about your relationship with him and what those lessons for life were. Where did you meet Alan?
I met Alan in my first internship, which was overseas, which was at Fetzer. And Fetzer at the time was, and Alvaro connected me with Fetzer at the time because as he was the winemaker for Carmen. Carmen was represented by Brown and Forman in the United States, which used to own Fetzer. So he had a connection with them, and he opened the doors for me, and he gave me an internship for 8 months at Fetzer. And being at Fetzer is where I met Alan. And that's how it all started. For me, it was fascinating to see this incredible personality. We become friends almost immediately, because he has kind of it was a very easygoing person. I was the cellar rat, so I didn't have much to add to the conversation, but he was very kind with me, and he invited me for dinner a couple of times, and he wanted to know more about Chile, and he knew Alvaro as well. So that's how it all started. And, you know, Alan has the most incredible life story, Tim. He left his house at a very early stage of his life at 17 years old. It was the late 60s in the United States. He was from Louisiana, so he has that very thick Southern accent, which for me, it was fascinating, because all the time I felt that I was like with Forrest Gump. I mean, all the time, I mean, having that conversations with him was fascinating. But not only his accent, his way of seeing things. When he left his house, Tim, he was illiterate.
Wow.
He hitchhiked to California. When he arrived to California, it was 1968. He was drafted to Vietnam, and he refused. And because of he refused, he was assigned to community work. And that community work put him in touch with some botanical gardens that were being built in the Santa Cruz Mountains, in the University of Santa Cruz. Those gardens were built by a gentleman, English guy, named Alan Chadwick. And Alan Chadwick was from a very wealthy family from England, and he had as a tutor Rudolf Steiner.
The founder of biodynamics, the inventor of biodynamics.
Yes.
Yeah. So Alan had a direct line to Steiner.
Direct line. He learned from the best. And Alan Chadwick, still, the botanical gardens are there. Yeah. And he always speaks very highly of Mr. Chadwick, how he taught him. And it's funny because he's been illiterate. And he always was very funny how he was telling his stories about how he learned about plants. He said, "Well, Rodrigo, I religiously, I have my stamp of LSD every morning, and the only thing that I remember is the images of the plants and what they like, what they don't like, and their habits of growth. And that's how he get interested in plants. And of course, that triggered a process of motivation and curiosity. Yeah. And then he read every single book about botanicals and botanics and plants and everything. So it's a fascinating process for me, as I was coming from a very scientific background, very square-minded. So it was, for me, it was not only a character, but a mentor. And and you know, one of the stories, when as you ask me about life, what he meant to me in my life. You know, Alan, I have an incredible story with him, that when I was at Matetich, so I get the chance to bring Alan to Chile at the time as a consultant. And when I was at Matetich, as you know, Tim, we were very successful in terms of exposure. The wines were phenomenal. It was a new region. Everybody was talking about it. And that obviously benefited me a lot. And one day we were walking in the vineyard, and he looked at me and he said, "You know, Rodrigo, you're doing so well." "Yeah, yeah, I'm so proud." Yeah, you should. "But you're going to do a lot better the day that you share your life with somebody." And I looked at him and said, "What do you mean?" "You will see." Years after, Tim, when I was working at Benziger, and I was doing very well as well in terms of the wines, were getting very good accolades, etc. And I was recently married to my wife. And he looked at me and he said, "Rodrigo, you're doing so well, but you're going to be better when you become a father." And that was like 5 or 6 years after. And a couple of years later, I figured out and I understood what he was trying to say when I become a father, when I was at the moment of delivery. And I see the gesture of the mother with the kid, with my daughter, and that transpassing of willing to do anything for that little creature that was being delivered was what Alan was trying to teach me, was about leaving your ego aside.
Yeah.
And the time that you leave the moment that you are able to share, to be generous, and to leave your ego aside, you become so much better at what you do.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And listen, I want to talk to you a little bit about the States, because, you know, you've worked there 5-6 times in your career, and in fruit storage, I noticed at one point. But at Fetzer, at Benzinger, at Kago, and now you're obviously at Quintessa. Yeah. I mean. Yep. Does it feel like home now, or are you still partly Chilean and partly American? What do you feel?
No, but my roots are in Chile, obviously. I mean, and I have strong roots. My family is there. My parents, my wife's parents, she's one of 5 sisters. I mean, imagine that. And it's and at the same time, my brother is there. But also, you realize, Tim, that when you get exposed to, and I've been. I always say I've been very rich in terms of opportunities, I mean, in my life, and I'm very grateful. You make your place, I mean, I don't feel that you belong to any place at this point. And honestly, the reason why we decided to come back is because I wanted to expose my daughters to a much more open-minded reality, which I think is the current world. I mean, you know... When those scenes that sometimes you feel like in London, for example, Tim, when you're walking downtown and you see people from all over the world, and it blows my mind to see all that. You know that sometimes Chile can be a little insular, and I thought that in that aspect, it's important. If I had the opportunity to show that to people that I love, I was definitely going to promote it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you've been working with the Huneus family since 2012, first in Chile and now in the States, obviously. Was your original focus with them on vineyards or on the winery or both? Because you do both, really. You're a winemaker who knows a lot about viticulture, which is quite unusual, I think.
Right. And Tim, when I decided to go back with my back to Chile in 2012, and I talked with Augustine, and I asked him for advice to Augustine Senior, to whom I should be talking with, and what should I do. And he gave me a couple of names, and you need to talk to this, to that. And 2 days after our conversation, he called me and said, you know what, don't talk to anybody. Let's work together. And I said, like, work on what? No, Vermont needs help. I mean, Neyen needs help. I mean, those are great projects. I want you to take over. And I say, well, I'll be very happy to do it, Augustine, but I have a very serious limitation, which is I will do it only if we shift gears in terms of conventional to organic and biodynamic farming. And he has accepted the challenge, and he supported. And we did an incredible job changing all that, Tim. I mean, we moved the needle of the Chilean statistics in terms of surface. I mean, we moved, it's more than 800 hectares of certified organic. It took us a while. It took us a lot of work. And of course, I didn't do all that by myself. I have a great team that support that, and they embraced the challenge immediately. But it was a fantastic, fantastic process.
Yeah.
And as you know, a lot of people were watching, and they were expecting failure. As you know how bad the human nature is cruel. And we did not fail. And actually, we brought back Veramonte to a very competitive level, and Neyen to be one of the best wines of the country, which makes me very proud, obviously. But being more than proud of what we achieve, proud of the team that we form and that we get a lot of things done together.
Let's talk a bit about Quintessa now, where you are now. It's a fascinating property, beautiful property. It had never been planted with vines when Agustin and his wife, Valeria, bought it in 1989. Just give us some sense of this place. And, you know, because it is, and it's very much an estate wine, isn't it? Do you think it's an advantage that you're making a wine, A, from an estate, and B, from an estate that's never had vines on it before until they came there in the early 90s?
Yeah, that's Tim. The property used to belong to an Armenian gentleman, Mr. Mardikian. Mardikian used to own a restaurant in San Francisco, a high-end restaurant. It was called Omar Khayyam, and and this was their party place. This was their party place, and actually we were looking at some old pictures the other day, and we found this picture with Elvis Presley and Mr. Mardikian kind of hanging out right next to the lake. And
so they probably drank wine and did a lot of drugs.
absolutely. So, and the property, to try to describe it, I mean, this is probably one of the most beautiful property in Napa Valley. I mean, it has a lake in the center. It's surrounded by five hillsides, incredible diversity of soils, incredible diversity of exposures. And the commitment from Valeria from the very beginning, Augustine's wife, was that I am not going to intervene this property, and I'm not going to add any chemicals to it. I'm going to treat it as it deserves to be treated. So from the very beginning, 1989, she was thinking about organics, and she planted according to the topography of the place without making any changes and without pulling any trees from the property. So quite unusual for the time.
It's a biosphere as well, in a way, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah. It's your little planet here, so your own ecosystem.
Hmm. I mean, it's interesting that Pedro Parra, the terroir specialist from Chile who works with you, he's described it as a very complex site. And Kelly White, the American wine writer, described it as a mini mountain on the valley floor. Just tell us briefly about the site. I mean, it's got the lake, it's got the river, it's mountainous, it's got slopes, it's soil diverse as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the property has two defining areas which define the region, huh? The region, as you know, Tim, goes north to south, the Napa Valley, which is a significant size. On the eastern side is the Vacas Mountains. And the Vacas Mountains, obviously, has been part of a very volcanic phenomena. And this property is at the foothills of the Vacas on one side. And on the other side, it's surrounded, I mean, the other natural border is the Napa River. So when you think about it, you have a volcanic phenomena on one side that probably it was quite recent. So it has compacted ash, kind of disturbance in the soils, cataclysms that probably creates those elevations. And on the other side of the property, you have an old river terrace. So doesn't get more diverse than that in this region. As you know, around Highway 29, it's pretty flat.
Yeah.
When you come to here, you don't even see Highway 29. It's absolutely it's a private environment. And at the same time, all those hillsides creates a lot of diversity. Mm-hmm. Working with Pedro in this site has been fascinating, as Pedro is fascinating as a person, but at the same time, incorporating all his understanding and his vision into what we're doing has been a really, really interesting process.
I mean, he's saying that you're doing Burgundy in Napa. You know, you've got, I don't know, I think 26 different blocks, is it? And you're fermenting all these different blocks separately, and you're making blends out of them. Just tell us about how different are the parcels and how different are the wines that they express.
You know, the beauty and the beauty of this property is that when you have that kind of volcanic ash, like tuff, completely white, that gives you a very chalky finish into the wines versus the red soils with cobblestones that gives you a little more backbone and more tannins versus the flat or the river right next to the river, which gives you a little bit of roundness and softness. In a very generalized way, you find a lot of diversity. I believe that, going back to your original question, if it's an advantage or not to work in a state like this, I think it's a tremendous advantage. Yeah. The only disadvantage is that it takes a little bit longer to figure it out, meaning probably a couple of generations. But when you put all those pieces together that gives you very vast diversity, I think that you can make an outstanding wine. Absolutely. The idea of isolating components, the Burgundy approach, for us to understand it, but then to blend them together and make a wine that has a lot of layers, is not that common in the region. And I think there's a tendency for the vineyard designates, which is isolate a plot and just express that. I think that gives you a single dimension. When you work with a property like this, you have multiple dimensions.
Yeah, that's the Bordeaux side of it. So you're mixing really a Burgundy approach in some senses with a Bordeaux approach. You're blending across the estate. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's always fascinating, you know, listening to you, and I'm always struck by this when I go to the Napa Valley, is how varied it is in terms of altitude, geology, climate, soil type. I mean, do you think consumers appreciate those differences, or is it about, you know, image and points and branding? Are those things taking over a bit?
You know, yes and no. I think that you, as a foreigner, you see the potential in terms of creating the regionality in the valley. But many years ago, Napa created its own brand, which is the Napa Valley. It's its own category. Now, to get deeper into that, I think it's absolutely necessary, and there are some really good producers working on it. But again, without having the international exposure and the need to explain, the need to teach, the need to educate, sometimes that message gets a little diluted in time. But I think it's absolutely necessary. And as you know, we are going through this process of starting to show Quintessa overseas. And this is part of the idea, similar to what we have done in Chile, for example, promoting the country, promoting the regions, and then understanding the regions, and then talk about the producer. Yeah. And I think it's so important to have collective efforts in order not only to promote, but to educate the audience that is eager to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, land is expensive in the Napa Valley, partly because it's close to San Francisco, but the fame of the wines as well. And do you think that makes people a little bit more conservative? Sometimes they think, oh, I can't dare, you know, I don't dare plant Petite Syrah or Zinfandel. Obviously, both are there. But I mean, I know that you've planted Carmenere. I wonder, was planting Carmenere, the Unaeus did, was that a bit of a risk, planting Carmenere, when they think, well, why aren't you planting Cab?
I think that that's where you see the confidence and the vision of the ownership. Yeah. Of course, when people see Carmenere or they hear that we have Carmenere, people think that what a waste. But you don't think like a grower. You think like a wine grower. And I think that's the difference. There's a lot of growers that it's a no-brainer to plant Cabernet Sauvignon because you get more return of your investment. But when you think as a wine grower and you're thinking about kind of the final picture, which is this beautiful blend that you're going to make from the property, I think varieties doesn't matter. And I think that's the process that we're going right. We're developing another property right behind Opus One, and that's exactly the mentality. We're going to do Merlot. We're going to do other varieties. We're going to have a kind of a very different blend, but not do the obvious. The most conservative decision and the logical one will be Cabernet Sauvignon.
Give us Give us an idea of, you know, what is the price of top Cabernet fruit as opposed to top, I don't know, Merlot fruit or Cabernet Franc fruit. I mean, what's the premium?
Well, the super premium. Let's say the famous vineyard designates that
like Tokalon or something well, like that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That could go up to 25,000 a ton, maybe more, because they have a very specific formula attached to the price of the bottle. So it's a very unique example. It's not the norm, and that's a very
That's the most expensive. Yeah.
Exactly. The average of Cabernet probably is around 12,000-13,000 a ton, yeah. And Merlot until last year was like 4,000-5,000. So it's a massive difference.
You can see why the growers want to plant Cabernet Sauvignon.
Of course, absolutely. It makes total sense, yeah. But it doesn't make sense if you want to make a wine with certain characteristics.
And if you're buying fruit, you don't buy fruit. But if you're buying fruit at $25,000 a ton, what price would you need to sell the wine at to make that viable?
The obvious is multiplied by 10, so it's
$250 a bottle. Yeah.
Yeah, which at the very end puts a lot of pressure on the maker. but it's sometimes it's those established methodologies that are very, very smart, and at the same time it creates a lot of attention. And the sites are very good. I mean, and let's don't detract from quality as well, and the farming is very precise, but at the same time, exactly, I think it distortions a little bit. And when you wanna produce wines from estates that sometimes it's going to have a different flavor profile, you get a little bit off category because people associate that vineyard designate with the max quality of the region, which may be debatable.
I think you're right. I mean, you also make a white wine, which is a fascinating blend of Sauvignon Musqué, Sauvignon Blanc, and a little bit of Semillon, I think, isn't it?
Yes.
What sort of style do you flavour? Because I know you worked in New Zealand for a bit, long time ago, didn't you? I just wonder, are you fascinated by Sauvignon? And what sort of style are you trying to make?
This is a wine that I've been watching for many years, since I started working with the Huneosis, and even before that. And that was what we applied for the concept of ritual. Basically, ritual Sauvignon Blanc used to have this concept of concrete fermentation.
Back in Chile, you're talking. Yeah.
Back in Chile, exactly. Yeah. The concrete fermentation, neutral oak, stainless steel, and a lot of different components. Today, the Quintessa winemaker, Rebecca, is where she put an incredible amount of work because she's a big fan of this wine. And I think that she had mastered the technique of Sauvignon Blanc and working in that sense together in it and observing the incorporation of Semillon, old vine Semillon, it gives you such a distinct flavor profile. I mean, so beautiful, and so I will say the texture of the wine has a very unique characteristic, in my opinion. So yeah, I think that Sauvignon Blanc Musqué gives you more floral characteristics and the freshness and the brightness of Sauvignon Blanc.
But it's more in a Bordeaux style than a New Zealand style, maybe we could say.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned Rebecca and you work alongside her. You obviously have a very good relationship. You're the estate director. She's the winemaker. So do you make the final calls? I mean, do you make the final decisions on the blends or do you do it together?
No, we do it together. And actually, in terms of winemaking, I will say that Rebecca is probably the best winemaker of her generation. So I think that in that aspect, I nurture myself as I hope that she nurtures herself from my way of thinking and our way of discussing the wines. But the very last call, it's hers. I mean, and I think it's very important that she feels empowered to do that. I try to add as much as we can through the tasting processes. We also have Michelle Roland as a blender consultant. But at the very end, the very last call it's on her.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's I think that's very good, isn't it? I mean, are you?
Yeah.
Just tell me a bit about how you feel about vintage variation. I mean, are you after consistency of style, or are you happy if there are, you know, noticeable differences between vintages?
I think variation is so important, Tim. I mean, it gotta be. It's a fundamental. I'm from an estate. Of course, you're gonna be in a range. It's not that we're gonna be falling apart one year and super overripe the other year. We gotta be in a segment of quality, basically. But variation, it's fundamental. It's what makes it attractive. It's what makes it interesting, and it's what makes the difference from year to year. And we're perceiving them more and more. And the way that we have been incorporating the work of Pedro, the work of Simone Tancerc, for example, the work of all this, I would say, super talented consultants that are helping us to find more the differentiations. We're creating an even broader spread in terms of variability, which we're happy with. And we are looking at showing those differences from year to year.
I mean, one of the differences you're getting, well, increasingly, it's something becoming very common, maybe not such a big difference, are problems with global warming and also wildfires. I just wonder, I mean, there's not a lot you can do about wildfires, maybe have fire breaks and things, but how are you dealing as an estate and as somebody who knows vineyards so well with global warming? Are you thinking about bigger canopies, about different varieties, different slopes, different sites? What are you doing?
You know, there are a couple of things that are very important, Tim, and that we dismissed in the past as a generation. I'm not saying over here. The importance of old vines, it's fundamental. Why? Because in the global warming conversation, nobody talks about the capacity of the vines to adapt. Everybody talks about this graphs of temperatures and kind of the corporate mentalities are pointing towards cooler regions where to buy farms or land. That's the obvious. But nobody is talking about committing and adapting. And I think that is very, very important to understand that plants have a capacity to adapt. And I firmly believe in that. And if we utilize, look how funny this is, so ironic that we talk about, for example, going on moving to cooler regions, but doing exactly the same. Nobody's talking about adjusting your farming and allowing the vines to adapt to the conditions that are presenting themselves. And honestly, it's not this gradual, as you know, it's not this gradual warming up. It's the peaks are different. Mm. So how you prepare yourself for the peaks, that is the key, in my opinion, in viticulture.
It's interesting. Do you think that biodynamic farming and organic farming also helps you against, it helps the vine to adapt and just make a stronger vine in a sense?
I have no doubt. I'm absolutely convinced biodynamic farming creates self-sufficient vines.
Yeah.
And they read the signals way better than we can do. So they are anticipating what's happening way before we can see them.
Yeah.
I think it's fundamental. I think biodynamic farming is the future of viticulture.
Could you define it for us? I mean, you know, in a few sentences. I know that's ridiculous and saying, how can you define this whole philosophy? Just for people who are listening and who don't understand biodynamics, it's very interesting what you've just said. Just give us the fundamentals, if you like.
Totally. I think that today is way easier to relate than before because of what we're going through, Tim. We are understanding what truly means what an holistic management is. With all what we're suffering because of pandemic and all those things, you realize that when you work with a property, you don't work with isolated variables. You work with a matrix that is dominated by nature. If you're capable to read the language of nature in a way that you help be proactive with all the techniques that is going to allow your primary cultivate to thrive, you are all the time making decisions in a proactive way, incorporating your knowledge, your science, but at the same time, what the property wants to do. So when you think about it as an organism, and you have different organs inside the property interacting together, is the mindset is completely different and normally doesn't caught you by surprise. Mm-hmm. You know what's going to happen. And that's why sometimes people talk about the old timers or the old farmers, that they have this capacity to be clairvoyancy.
Yeah.
It's not clairvoyancy. It's to know the plants in a way that you know how they're going to react.
Yeah.
It's anticipating. It's anticipating.
Very interesting. I remember when I first talked to Alvaro Espinosa, who we mentioned earlier at Vina Carmen, about this, and he said that the people who understood biodynamics fastest were the people who worked in the fields because they'd done that all their lives. Therefore, they were used, as you said, to observing what was going on and watching the plants and having a relationship, not just with the plants, but with the land and with nature. And they got it. Whereas I think for some of us who grow up in cities, it's a little bit more complicated, maybe.
It's absolutely very difficult to decipher. But like the vineyard manager that I work here, Martin, he's an extension of the property. Mm. The guy knows exactly what's going to happen in every single block before it happens.
Yeah.
And he sees the reaction and the responses of the plants.
Yeah.
And he pointed me in that direction. I mean, like, let's say for green thinning, for example. And he pointed me and said, Rodrigo, did you saw the response of the plants? No, Martin, what are you talking? They are relieved. They're more erect. They are thriving right now. Mm-hmm. He sees all those things. I mean, it's so important.
So it's empathy, it's intuition, it's observation, it's experience, it's all of those things really, isn't it?
Yeah. It's connection. That connection with nature, it's fundamental to keep it alive.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I mean, one thing I want to ask you at the end really is, do you still keep in touch with Chile? You've said you do. Are you surprised by what Chile has achieved in the last decade? I mean, you were at the beginning of it, really, with Matatich, and then what you did at Veremonte, and particularly with Nien. Do you look at Chile now and think, wow, that's amazing?
There's so many things going on in Chile in a positive way. I think that it's every change, every getting out of the suit. I mean, it's difficult on any aspect. In terms of viticulture and winemaking, of course it took a while, but it makes me so proud to see and to find wines from small producers, and they are the mavericks today. Mm-hmm. They are the guys that are trying to kind of plant the new flags out there and be independent and figured out how to make it. It's very inspirational. It's fantastic.
Do you sometimes miss it a bit?
I do. And lately I haven't been able, but of course I have a lot of friends that you know very well. And it's just inspiring to see all what they're doing. So it's always very refreshing. And that's kind of the beauty of being back and forth, that you can see all that progress and all those changes and all those, and refresh your mind as well and be inspired all the time.
Yeah, fantastic. Final question. Just how do you get away from wine? I mean, you're a land guy. You're a big wine taster, you're a big wine drinker, you're a fun guy. How do you switch off?
You know, that's a difficult question, Tim, because a couple of things. I mean, it's part of my family. My wife works in wine as well. And we have a little family project together. So it's very difficult for us, but it's part of our culture. It doesn't feel like something additional to our lifestyle. I was trying to ride my bike, but I just decided to get a new puppy. I have never been a dog person, but this, I become a father again. I mean, like it's completely, I'm fully dedicated to this little guy, and it's keeping me very busy and has been great because the connection, it's another part of the connection with nature and animals being something special. I mean, as I've been talking, you have been hearing about regenerative and incorporating animals to properties and this, and even having your dog right next to you is such a connection that, again, I don't want to miss it.
Listen, I better let you go and finish moving house because you've got to go and hump some boxes, man. Anyway, lovely, lovely talking to you.
Likewise, Tim. Thank you so much.
See ya.
Cheers.
What a pleasure to chat with Rodrigo, and I do hope his house move went smoothly. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is Jesus Madrazo, one of Spain's most legendary winemakers. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.